there's an event, and then what happens is you have to figure out how to respond. That is very different than COVID, where the crisis kept evolving. It's like you didn't have one event and say, okay, how are we going to deal with it? What happens is you're dealing with the event, and then the next day something changes in the event.
Organizations and workplace event organizers or whatever have a really big responsibility to stop this assumption that everybody drinks. It just has to stop. It actually has to stop. It's utterly ridiculous. That just cannot carry on.
You can protect people, but not jobs. Which I mean by that is, you know, technology will continue to advance quickly, right? And you can put your head in the sands and think, well, you know, we're absolutely fine. We're not going to embrace it, but your competitors probably will be. Right, to get, you know, maybe superior customer service, greater efficiencies, productivity, etc.
Welcome to the Connected Leadership Podcast, hosted by Andy Lapata, the show where Andy and his guests explore the many ways in which relationships impact business decisions, make leaders' jobs easier, and help you to progress your career.
Hello, and welcome to the Connected Leadership Podcast. I'm Andy Lapata. Thank you very much for joining me. We're going to look into the future now. We're going to get our crystal balls out and see what the future of work looks like, what it holds for your team and your colleagues, and as a connected leader, what you can do to help people prepare for the future and look forward to it as a land of opportunity rather than something to fear and worry about. The person I have to explore this with me is very well qualified to do so. He's PwC's global workforce leader. He leads a team of over 10,000 people who are supporting organizations with their workforce opportunities and challenges. He was named in the top 25 human capital consultants this year in the Financial Times Women of the Future Kind Leaders list. And in June, he led PwC's contingent at the World Economic Forum summer meeting in China, where they released their hopes and fears survey, which is the largest workforce survey of its kind, with 58,000 respondents across all sectors in 47 countries. If that doesn't convince you that this is the man to talk to, then I'm sure his conversation will. Pete Brown, thank you very much for joining me on the Connected Leadership Podcast.
Hello, Andy. I'm delighted to be here and thank you so much for inviting me along. I look forward to having a chat.
Well, thanks for coming on. And you know, I think that the future of work is such a hot topic. It's a constantly moving one. It's something we've touched on in previous conversations on the Connected Leadership Podcast. But it's good to do a deep dive and not just on the obvious stuff necessarily. And I'll be interested to see what sort of things you bring up. I have a few ideas about what topics might be pressing, but I'm sure that you have other things that we can think about. Before we get into what the future of work looks like and what it holds for us, I'm always intrigued by how change changes and particularly the pace of change. We know that there's probably been more changes in workplace environment in the last decade, I would assume, than any time in history. But I would be intrigued to know from your perspective how the pace of change that we're experiencing even now in the 2020s and post-pandemic era differs from the 2010s and how all of that differs from when you and I started our careers.
Great question to start with, Andy. You know, cliche time, you know, changes are constant, right? But I think actually it is getting faster and faster and faster. I mean, just think back to, you know, let's throw a bit of data at this. When TikTok was launched, it took 9 months to get 100 million users. You know, wow, that's fast. Gen AI comes onto the scene in November. It got to 100 million users in 2 months. It got even faster, right? And then more recently, Threads was launched. It got to 100 million users in under a week. So I think, you know, there is just one example of many I could give around the pace of change. And I think it's because there are so many things going on, just impacting us, frankly, as human beings. Forget about work for a moment. We talk a lot, we have done for some time, around what we term the mega trends, you know, which are these just huge, deep and profound trends that are impacting us as human beings on the planet, that are global in their scope and long-term in their effect. You know, and these are things like climate change, like disruptive technology, changing demographics around the world, fracturing world and what have you. When we first started talking about those, it was a little over 10 years ago. I think with some justification at that time, that the response was kind of, yeah, we kind of get it. And that's something we will address in the next year or so and sort of kick it into the long grass. I think what's become apparent, certainly in the last couple of years, is, you know, delaying is no longer an option. We've got to deal with these crises because otherwise I think the consequences, you know, could be very bleak. If we look at the changes in climate that we're living in, just look at the news last night, you know, for example, the flooding in Greece, for example. Look at the reality of generative AI, you know, ChatGPT, you know, I think has propelled AI from being some kind of hype into reality, impacting all parts of the way we live and work. The Russian invasion of Ukraine, COVID-19, you know, huge accelerators of a world which is frankly in danger of fracturing. And social instability, you know, levels of misinformation being spread, levels of trust that people have at all-time lows. They're all, if you like, short-term crises that are manifestations of those longer-term crises we have. I could add to that list some of the short-term things we're battling with, rising inflation rates, mentioned the war in Ukraine, the energy crisis, you know, some banks going under, shortage of healthcare workers. The list goes on and on and on. And I think that the pace, the frequency will increase. And I think the challenge for organizations, for governments, for individuals is we have to respond quickly and we have to respond in a coordinated fashion. You can't deal with those different trends in isolation. They're all interconnected. So long way of answering your question, but the pace of change is increasing and that's not going to change anytime soon.
And what really strikes me from what you've said there is I think there's two levels at which we need to look at this. One is the macro level, and all of the examples you've given there, I think are examples of macro changes, global changes, changes in our environment, changes in the geopolitical situation and so forth, changes in the economy. And then there's the micro changes. And while these still impact at a huge level, they have a more direct impact perhaps on the day-to-day running of a business or the day-to-day engagement of a team. AI being a good example of that, new social media platforms and so forth. And then it would come into what someone's role in an organization is as to at what point they engage. So is there a distinction between if you are the CEO of a FTSE 100 or New York Stock Exchange listed company, and what you have to be looking at versus the head of human resources, the sales director, the head of learning and development for a region, for EMEA, for example, in any organization, or a small business owner? Are you going to be looking at different levels of that macro, micro distinction in terms of what's relevant to you in your role and what's going to impact your team?
Yeah, look, I think day to day you are, just given, you know, some of the roles you outlined there, you know, the scale, the reach, and probably the product and industry set. But I think fundamentally, even if you distill it down, irrespective of you're a global multinational CEO or, you know, a private business in one territory or an HR director, what have you, I think there are consistent challenges that face us all actually around the world. You're absolutely right. There are the micro and the macro trends, but yeah, you referred in the introduction to the Hopes and Fears survey, which we launched. For us, it's just a really wonderful way just to work out what's on the minds of people, workers, right? What's making them tick? And the manifestation of cost of living crisis, right? That is impacting people today. We know the number of people with disposable income having paid the bills at the end of the month has decreased sharply in the last year. We know that, you know, if you think in the pandemic, where I think, you know, one of the positive things that came out of the pandemic is I think it really shone a light on the importance of mental health and support and the provision of. And I think we saw some fantastic advances there, which are continuing in many organizations. In response to the cost of living, I think for organizations to put in place mechanisms to support people's financial well-being, because it does cause stress to them personally, which will impact how they do their job. Why does that matter? That matters to an organization, because if people are stressed and they're not fully engaged in their job, they're not going to be the most productive, right? And I think whether you're a multinational or a smaller SME organization, you know, you want to delight your customers, you want to satisfy your shareholders, your stakeholders. And to do that, you need an engaged, motivated workforce that is delivering the strategy and executing whatever your business happens to be.
Let's look then at another distinction, and that's one between crises and opportunity, because again, you listed a lot of major challenges to business, to the teams working for them, and for society in general. You also talked about AI, you talked about new social media and so forth, which many people see as opportunity. With some of those things, we need to, as you say, respond urgently. The climate crisis is a good example of that. With new technology, I'm really interested in your take on this. I don't know if you ever saw the Pixar film Up. I think it was a Pixar film. But the dog that's sitting there looking at one thing and a squirrel goes past and it just immediately turns the other way. It goes, squirrel! And I have a sort of joke with a few friends that, you know, the next shiny thing comes on and you just look the other way and go, squirrel. So when AI came along, a lot of speakers were saying, you've got to be on ChatGPT. You've got to be using this. I sat back and I let it settle. And then I found the right ways to use it for me. When a new iPhone comes out, I don't tend to rush and buy it straight away. I wait and see till they've detected the bugs. So when we are responding to change, and particularly ones that provide opportunity, is it important to dampen down the squirrel tendency and jump to the next shiny object? I'm probably mixing my animal metaphors there, and actually have a process which allows us to reflect and consider what, you know, as people start using it.
I think that there's a lot in that question, Andy, and the squirrel analogy I love. I work with an organization where the principal person I work with, she will observe in her organization a tendency to, you know, shout squirrel every now and then, and everybody turns left and right and follows it and what have you. Let's just focus on the technology angle that you mentioned there. So, you know, Gen AI is the latest one, but that's not new, right? It's been around for a number of years. The manifestation of it, perhaps more, you know, more widespread, particularly with ChatGPT coming out. But I think, you know, others have been talking about the impact of disruptive technology and the advances of technology for many, many years, and how that's enabling us to do our jobs differently. And a phrase we've coined and we use a lot in the context of this is, you can protect people but not jobs. By which I mean by that is, you know, technology will continue to advance quickly, right? And you can put your head in the sands and think, well, you know, we're absolutely fine, we're not going to embrace it, but your competitors probably will be, right? To get, you know, maybe superior customer service, greater efficiencies, productivity, etc. So I think embracing the technology, being inquisitive about it, and I think Gen AI is a classic. I would urge organizations to be experimenting with Gen AI. Now, it's not perfect, but it brings huge opportunity, albeit some risks, which we can talk about. But I think if I put the workers' lens on as well, as we know, we saw this actually in the pandemic, you know, 76% of workers were up for and positively engaging in developing new skills. You know, human beings, being human beings, they're bright, smart things, people, and they can see what's coming along, you know, on the horizon. They've been aware, they see the technological advances coming, they see the opportunity. In our Hopes and Fears survey, workers are, the majority are positive around Gen AI specifically. They say that it brings opportunity for them to develop new skills. They say that they can see it taking away some of the mundane in their existing jobs. And they can see it opening up new opportunities and new work, which I completely agree with. So I think being thoughtful and planful around how you engage in it as an organization, experimenting, recognizing it's not perfect, you know, for example, some of the inherent biases in it, and you know, being slightly playful, having a culture where it's okay to experiment. I've got many colleagues at the moment that do all sorts of wonderful things with technology. And you know what? Some of it's fantastic and revolutionary. Some of it's a disaster. That's fine. We learn so much. We develop from that. And I think, again, if I put myself in the shoes of workers, right, it's a great opportunity to learn, develop, to get those new skills, to maintain relevance. Now, I think what is a slight concern from the data, from our research, is that if you're in a job where you require specialist skills, you self-identify, then broadly you will get lots of opportunity for learning, for developing those skills provided by your employer. You will also have an awareness that you can see technology, Gen AI in particular, impacting your role. So you can take action around that. The concerning part for me is those who are not in, in jobs that require specialist skills, it's almost as if this wave of technology is coming upon them and they don't quite realize it's going to happen. They'll say they don't think it's going to impact their job. I would suggest actually it is going to impact their job significantly. So I think it's incumbent on organizations and leaders to provide opportunity for people to develop skills. I'd urge people to take those opportunities because A, I think you'll enjoy it, but B, I think it will develop your CVs and maintain your relevance in the world of work.
Well, let's dig a bit more deeply into that then. As you've intimated, there are a lot of concerns, particularly, you mentioned non-technical roles, but actually even in technical roles, there are people that are fearing for their future because AI can supposedly do it better. As an author, I'm now seeing stories of AI books. There was a book about the fires in Hawaii that hit the bookshelves in 2 days after the fire that was AI generated. Amazon took it down very quickly. Now, the ones that are coming out at the moment, the ones that are being recognized as AI generated, I should say, are poor and not necessarily competition, but that's only going to evolve. So I think every profession, or many professions have some level of fear. So from your perspective, from the research that you've done today and from helicopter view, so to speak, which are the professions that you think are going to have the biggest challenges protecting jobs that could be done by AI? And you've talked about training and relearning, but what should leaders be doing to both calm the fears, manage the fears of their team and keep them motivated, but also if it's a genuine challenge, how are they going to help them really reposition themselves so that they don't find themselves stranded without
a role? So look, I think, Andy, let me sort of deconstruct that, because I think if I start, I'll refer to, so every year PwC, we survey about 5,500 CEOs around the world, right? And we launch it in January. And again, if you like, that's a balance to the hopes and fears of the workers. Now, for as long as I can remember, and I've been with PwC just now on 14 years, every single year in the top three or four concerns of CEOs has been access to the right talent, but also the right skills. And when we've broken that down, the skills they're talking about actually aren't the classical technical skills. They're actually those innate human skills: problem solving, critical thinking, leadership, ability to network, ability to collaborate, interpersonal skills, right? And this year was no different, right? So I'll just put that out there around that requirement from organizations of all shapes and sizes around the world for those human skills. Now, back to what we were talking about earlier on, the pace of change, the advance of technology increases. And I think we're seeing the next iteration of that. And for me personally, and I think as an organization, we talk a lot about actually this humans and technology working in concert. Technology does brilliant things, but it doesn't do everything. It can't replicate many of those innately human qualities and skills that are required. For example, let's look at sort of doctors, for example. AI-powered diagnostic tools are certainly improving accuracy and efficiency in healthcare. But the human aspects of medicine, patient care, empathy, complex decision-making, that's really hard to replace by technology. You need those human skills. And I could go on. So I don't tend actually to look at it as something that's going to sweep away entire professions. I think what is pretty much consistent across all professions, though, is that they will be impacted to a greater or lesser extent by technology and Gen AI. Another classic, I think, is the legal profession. A large part of what sort of the legal profession do can be positively impact in terms of efficiency and speed, drafting and what have you. But ultimately, you still require that human being to provide the judgment and to interpret what the technology, what the Gen AI is providing, right? To make those decisions, to provide the wisdom, if you like, in that particular sector. But I think it brings into sharp focus, though, a challenge for organizations to really prove the value they're delivering to their clients, right? And what our clients pay for. And that, again, across a whole range of sectors and professions.
So if I can summarize what you said there very succinctly, you're basically saying that the human skills of building strong relationships, building the right connections are absolutely imperative. And everyone should really be looking to work with experts in that field and listening to their podcasts and reading their books. That would be the absolute summary.
And I think I can think of no book better than yours and your podcast. Absolutely. But I think, I think, if I just add to that, I think, for me, the way I view it is it's around how does technology augment and support as opposed to eliminate, right?
Yeah.
And I think many organizations, sorry,
I had to put that shameless plug in there just based on what you said. But actually, I do want to pick up on something else you said there. And you talked about the onus goes on to the professions and the organizations to prove their value to customers. If we look at how a leader can support their team through this transition and through those fears, would therefore some of the answer be that the leader works with those team members to help them understand the own value they bring, to bring out much more clearly the strengths of individuals and what they bring to the party, to help them to understand it, to value it for themselves and to focus on it so that they can bring the best out of themselves and reach their potential and put themselves above that AI-generated alternative?
Look, completely. And I think implicit in what you're talking about there around, if you like, the role of the leader, there's so much there. I think there's the role modelling you talk about. And if I think, I think some of the brilliant leaders I see operating, they role model, they communicate clearly, and I think it's a bit like, hybrid working, right? When that happened, some leaders were really clear with their workforces and workers knew, right? They might not have liked what they were being asked to do, and that's fine, but they couldn't argue that their organization, their leaders weren't being clear. There were some other organizations where confusion reigned because there was absolutely no clarity from the leaders, right? I think it's the same with the technology. It's being clear and purposeful around how you're using it, why you're using it, what outcome you're using it. I think role modeling those behaviors. Yeah. And I think for me, I'm just a passionate believer in great leaders surround themselves with brilliant people, right? And their role is, if you like, I think to create that empowered environment, to empower those individuals, to let them be brilliant, right? how do you set the direction, communicate, motivate, and create that inclusive environment for people to thrive.
If you're in a leadership position and would like to review your own professional relationship strategy, you may be interested in booking a 15-minute call with Andy. Please visit andylapata.com/discovery to find out more.
Let's use that insight as a bridge to our next topic, because I think we focused in on AI a lot, but I don't want this to be solely about AI. And you've talked about how great leaders can really bring out the best in their people. One of the challenges to that in the changing working environment, it could be argued, is the shift to remote and hybrid working. Yeah. So what have you seen in terms of how that's impacted the workplace? Because, what I'm seeing in the papers and the discussion programs is there's always been a resistance to it and a question mark over it. But you even see Zoom now, the CEO of Zoom saying that you can't innovate on remotely and you can't have meaningful conversations remotely, and a move to companies interviewing new candidates in person because you can only get to know people like that. So do you think that remote and hybrid working, I think, will always be there to a degree, but do you think the shift away from property into shared spaces, remote working, hybrid working was a bit of a fad, or do you think it has changed the landscape for good? And how do we adapt for that and how we engage with our teams?
Wow, if I had a pound for every time I've been asked that question, actually.
Yeah, I knew it wasn't the most original I've ever asked.
No. But it's so relevant at the moment, Andy, you're right. Yeah, I mean, because there's a lot, right? It comes and goes, but right now there's quite a lot of a focus on that. And I think, look, first and foremost, there's no one size fits all. There's no one organization or two organizations doing the same thing. There's a variety. And we've still got the extremes. We've got some organizations, very clearly they want their people back in a physical place of work 5 days a week. We've got others, no, they're still happy with entirely remote, and we've got hybrid and somewhere in between. For me, I think it's what's right for your business, right? And depending on how you're trying to sort of, to get that best service to your customers and to your colleagues, right, and to your employees. And I think for me, it is another tool, if you like, that leaders have, organizations have, in terms of the deal they offer their employees, right, we know from all the surveys we do with workers that workers do appreciate and want flexibility, right? By and large, the majority do. We know, we've lived through, we're seeing, we've talked about the tsunami of technology, right? The pandemic, you know, suddenly Zoom, Teams, you name it, right? You know, collaborative ways of working, you know, and that forced, you know, because of the existential threat, it forced people to suddenly be 100% working remotely. And, you know, depending on the data you look, but broadly, it didn't impact productivity in most sectors. But I think it's been really clear about why and where you want people to work. If I take PwC as an example, you know, for us, actually, we encourage our people to be in the office, you know, 3 or 4 days a week, because a lot of what we do requires problem solving, collaboration, judgment making, and actually doing that in person. You know, personally, I find that much easier. I mean, I'm a people person. I enjoy being with human beings. Now, I'm not everybody's wired like me, and I totally respect that. But I think, again, it's slightly back to that kind of point around the communications and being clear. Be clear about what you expect as an organization. You know, the workers and colleagues can then decide whether that fits their purpose. Now, I do think, though, there are some cautionary things around the, you know, for example, let's get everybody back 5 days a week. I think, you know, when we were talking about the pandemic earlier on, it shone a lens on mental health. I think also there were some great positives in people being able to work around their personal lives. I think particularly for carers, particularly for females, actually, that there were some advantages there. So I think you've got to be very careful around that you don't lose some of those benefits that we found in that time. But I think also on the sort of challenging side of remote work, you know, there were some mental health issues, there were increasing, there were people who were suffering with isolation. And so I think, again, it's just being clear about your strategy, creating that experience for your employees such that they can be the most productive. And I think also being clear around those kind of barriers or the boundaries between personal life and work life, which I think many people struggled with, particularly in the early days of the pandemic.
If you put yourself in 5 years' time and you're looking at the landscape of how people work, do you think it will have settled down to something that looks completely different to pre-pandemic, in that we will still have a lot of 3-day in the office, 2-day from home hybrid working, more hot desking offices, and so forth, and that there will be a lasting impact from the move to remote working over the last few years?
Well, yeah, no, I think it will settle down in 5 years' time. If I think of some of the organizations I work with, right, there's a number I can think of on the top of my head that, you know, that they viewed in a very holistic manner, right? They don't just view it as, oh, we've got some technology that can enable remote working, so we'll just switch that on. They've actually thought about it in a really planned way around, what does that mean for the physical workplace? Do we need the same footprint that we've had before? Some do. Some have rationalized. Some are rationalizing. They thought about the technology implications. How do they optimize that? And again, they've often put the employee at the center as well from an experience lens. So I think some form of hybrid will be here to stay, but there will be exceptions. Right? There'll be some that are entirely remote. There'll be some that are entirely in person. But that will be something that those organizations have judged is right for their business and for their clients and for their customers and their people.
Yeah, I mean, I have a client that's very much in the innovation space, and the message from the very well-known leader of that organization is, if you want to work here, you work from here, and otherwise you find a different job. So, well, yeah.
I was going to add to that as well, is if you think about how it's constantly evolving, there's been a number of well-documented studies around the world around, for example, 4-day weeks, 9-day fortnights, right? I can't remember off the top of my head, but I was reading a couple of days ago. I think there's a council in the UK.
Scotland, to introduce it for public sector workers. Yeah.
Public sector workers. Yeah. That clearly will prompt a loud debate. Of course it will, just by its very nature. But I think that there are private sector organizations as well that have been experimenting. I think Microsoft in Japan is a good example. And actually, there's some really interesting findings there in terms of productivity, again, no discernible decline, increases in engagement of workers. For me, it's a little bit like the hybrid working. It's another tool in the arsenal of leaders around you know, how can they support their workers to be able to bring their best to work?
Yeah, and it is what I wanted to ask you about next, because I've been listening to that debate as well, and I've been interested for a while. I think they trialled it quite extensively in France a couple of years ago, maybe even just pre-pandemic. But my first permanent roles after university were civil service roles, where we worked on flexi time, where we had to do, and I can't believe it as I say it out loud nowadays, but we had to do 36 hours a week, and anything beyond that, you weren't allowed to do it. I mean, you, in the course of a month, you had to make up that time or take days off. But everything was about clocking in, clocking out, effectively keeping timesheets. I get the sense that we are moving, and it may just be me, but I get the sense we're moving more towards a productivity culture rather than a clock in, clock out culture. You think of the old footage from the 1950s of factory workers going in and punching their cards on the way in and out. I think we've moved a long way away from that. Yeah. Is that your experience as well?
Yeah, completely. I would link it again slightly with the hybrids. When the pandemic hit, that threw rocket fuel on the whole idea of presenteeism, right? Because it had to, by necessity. And I think that caused, you know, a sharper focus around productivity and accountability and results-based performance, right? Because there was no hiding place from that. And I think we will see more of that. You know, there's a lot of emphasis on productivity. But again, when you break this all down, for me, it all comes down to trust, right? I'm really fortunate. I work in an organization which is very trusting. I'm trusted and I trust, and I trust my colleagues. And we kind of know what's expected of us. And I think when you have that kind of culture and that environment, actually, yes, we have timesheets and all the rest of it, but I'm trusted to deliver what I'm supposed to deliver and work as I'm expected to work. I think the challenges are when that trust breaks down, obviously. So for me, it starts with that culture of trust, that bit empowering your workers. And I think the lens on productivity, the clocking in, clocking out, you know, that served a function at a moment of time, and it still does in some industries. But I think, again, having that flexibility for how people work is really important. And it's something that, you know, we do live in a world where there is a shortage of skills. Despite the kind of the pressures we face at the moment, we have a shortage of skills around the world. So we have to offer that flexibility to workers.
It's funny when you talk about presenteeism, because it has been a major thing in the past for so many organizations. And yet when I've talked to sales leaders, their biggest complaint for years has always been, I don't want to see my team sitting in the office. I want them out. It's funny. So presenteeism can show in different forms. There's one more question I've got about that workplace culture. And again, I think it comes to something that first showed its head, if I remember correctly, in France, but is also still in the news now and still being debated. And that is switching off communications, work communications outside working hours. So there's still this debate about whether, I think there's been a debate about whether there should be legislation stopping companies from emailing their employees outside contracted hours and so forth. What are you seeing in that space? Do you think with the advent of email communications, because when I started out working, it was physical letters and phone calls. And I remember the shift to email where, but that first job in the civil service, we were expected to reply to a letter in 28 days. I remember I used to run a national business network of breakfast meetings. And I remember being a breakfast meeting at the other end of the country, getting back to the office for about 11 o'clock. So maybe I was in the Midlands, got back to the office about 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock. Someone had emailed me at 7:30 in the morning and 8 o'clock, because they'd had a problem with their meeting and they were complaining I hadn't replied. So there was a real shift from 28 days expectation to 28 minutes.
Yeah.
Are we seeing reversion back to reasonable expectations of engagement?
Yeah, it's not something, if I'm honest, it's not a conversation point I have on a regular basis. Mm. But I think you summed it up. I think what I observe with many of the organizations I work with and my own organization is kind of that it's kind of trust in the individual, right? So I've got some colleagues will put on their email footer, I'm sending this note now, this email now, because it suits me, suits my life, but I don't expect you to reply, right? Until, and for me, it's that kind of trust and that clarity and being clear out of communications. Personally, I'm not a huge fan of mandating For example, I do some of my best thinking actually late at night, and I'll, you know, write emails. I'll actually delay this, you know, I'll time it so they send at a reasonable time. But I wouldn't want to have that ability for me to do my work in the time that suits me restricted. Now, whether I'm representative of everybody, I don't know. I've not done any research in that area, but I think it's around that respect for the individual. And I think, you know, if people tend to be attracted to stay with organizations where the value set, the behavior, the culture kind of mirrors their own. Yeah, and if there's a misalignment there, then they won't hang around, they'll leave. And so I think for me, that's kind of, if you like, one of the hygiene factors of where you're working, right? You would work out, I think, pretty quickly whether it's an environment that's right for you or not.
I think for me, that's such an important point. People want to work in a place where the values align with their own. And I think that's, yeah, for me, probably one of the biggest shifts over the course of my career, that you go from working in a place where it's a hierarchy and they tell you what you do and that's it. And why are you talking back? Why do you want to, you know, I'm senior to you. Don't, you know, just do what you're told.
Yeah.
To one where we're engaging a lot more with employees, with our teams more widely, and external stakeholders as well.
Well, and I think if you think about those kind of classical hierarchies, yeah, they're kind of where, you know, certainly when I started working, the person at the top had all the knowledge, right? And it was fed down at a time of their choosing. That's kind of gone out the window now with the huge amount of data that's just accessible, you know, within seconds. If you think about things like Glassdoor and Fishbowl, for example, right? You want to know what your employees think about your organization. Well, just come spend 5 minutes having a look on those apps, right? Because they're very clear about it and they won't hold back. And I think there's that demand of employees around what they expect from the organization in which they work.
Talking about hierarchies, just a brief observation is that even in what you might consider to be the most hierarchical organizations, they're no longer the same structures. So I've had a few people from the military background on the podcast, and they've stressed that the military isn't as hierarchical as we might think it is, and we perceive it.
I can say with some certainty, because I'm a veteran myself. Yeah. You know, in the Air Force for 10 years, and I'm a very proud reservist to this day. And yes, there is the classical hierarchical structure, but the best leaders I worked for there, it wasn't the command and control. It was actually those that created that environment for people to bring their best, right? And created that empowerment, that innovative environment for people to thrive and to develop themselves clearly in conjunction with the aims of the organization. But yeah, I know it, from the outside, it looks like a command and control pyramid, but actually those best leaders, you know, I would say we're at the other end of the spectrum in how they operated and led.
So we've talked about, obviously, AI. We've touched very briefly on social media because we cover it so much on the podcast.
Yeah.
We've talked about the working environment. What else is coming over the horizon that we really need to be aware of?
I think it was when Tony Blair became Prime Minister, his mantra was education, education, education.
Yeah.
I would say in this day, it's skills, skills, skills. Right. I think developing the right skills to be relevant in the world of work, organizations promoting that and enabling their people to. And I think that's very much, I think, the currency we're seeing in the world of work. I think jobs as we know them will be deconstructed. And again, in conjunction, I think, with preferences of workers, you know, people want to be engaged in meaningful work. They want to be able to apply their skills in areas of interest, right, where they're challenged, where they're learning new skills. And that, I think, doesn't conform necessarily to the classical, I go in a job and I'll work in that and I'll just keep my head down and I'll go to the next one. People aren't joining organizations for life these days. They will be much more of a kind of a climbing wall, sort of stepping stone kind of career, where they'll move from different experiences. And I think certainly within many of the large multinationals I work with, we're seeing much greater focus around enabling employees to be mobile, to be able to move from different departments, different functions, different territories. For example, if I think about my own organization, the PwC, we have a really active program where colleagues have cycles of experience in different parts of the world to get that different experience with different cultures, different organizations, different customer bases. And I think we will see much more focus on that and much more focus around the skills. What are the skills we need? What are the skills we've got today? how do we bridge that gap? How do we develop? How do we hire in new skills? How do we develop those new skills? So I think it's actually a really exciting time, particularly for those in the kind of the people workforce, HR professions.
Pete, thank you so much for your insights and your foresight. I really appreciate it. I promised an interesting conversation and I've thoroughly enjoyed this. There's so much to think about in terms of where we're going in the future and where we started out, that pace of change even now and adapting to it and thinking about it. And you've given us a lot to mull over. So thank you very much for joining me on the Connected Leadership Podcast.
Thanks very much. An absolute pleasure, Andy.
So thanks again to Pete for joining me on the podcast. I always love conversations like that. There's so much we could cover and I like to respect the amount of time we really have available, but some good thoughts. I think one thing that we didn't talk about, maybe touched on a little bit, but just for me to bring this back into the theme of the podcast wholly, is everyone is going through these changes at the moment. Everyone is dealing with this and you don't have to address them on your own. You don't have to work your way through it by trial and error, but make sure you're learning from each other. Make sure you're talking to other people who are going through and addressing the same challenges, who are looking at how am I using AI. I'm using AI a lot now, but I'm doing it because I turned to people I trust who had already embraced it and understood the best ways they were doing that and took what was right for me. The same with how are you dealing with staff's requirements around hybrid working versus what you want in an organization or a team. Talk to other people in the same position. So a connected leader will connect and will ask and will learn from their colleagues and will share their own experiences as well. So I think that'll be my addition to the conversation and just get you to think about, okay, conversations like this and listening in is one thing and it's really helpful to set the scene, but now go and share it with someone else and work out where you'll go forward from there. So I hope that's useful and I hope it's a useful starting point for you as you move forward to the next wave of change in your career and in your role as a leader. And to help you on that journey, join us again next week for another episode of the Connected Leadership Podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Connected Leadership Podcast. If you found this valuable, please subscribe, tell your colleagues and friends, share on social media, and post a review on the podcast channel you use to listen to it. And of course, join us again soon for another interesting interview and great connected leadership tips.